We'll hear argument now on number 95489, the Colorado Republican Federal Campaign Committee versus Federal Election Commission. Mr. Barron, is that the correct pronunciation?
That's correct. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, the Colorado Republican Party, like any party, has a lot to say about issues and candidates. But when it starts talking about congressional issues and congressional candidates, it becomes subject to a federal law that limits that type of core political speech. From the inception of this case, the Colorado Republican Party has asked that this federal law, Section 441 AD3, be declared unconstitutional because it needlessly prevents our speech, speech that we are ready, willing, and able to engage in. The FEC has also accused my client of violating the statute by virtue of financing a radio advertisement known as Worth Facts Number 1. The FEC would like my client punished for this alleged violation. Thus, this case presents two important issues to the court. The first issue was alluded to in this court's opinion in Buckley versus Vallejo 20 years ago. That issue is, does the First Amendment permit Congress to limit a political party's speech, including speech that contains express advocacy in support of the party's own candidates? If this court upholds such a limit, then the second issue is raised, which is, are political parties entitled, at the very least, to clear guidance as to which of its speech is subject to a spending limit and which speech is not?
Well, Mr. Barron, I thought there was another possible question here, which is whether the statute, as presently drafted, covers this expenditure at all. This was an advertisement, as I understand it, paid for by the Colorado Political Committee at a time when there was no Republican nominee for the Senate, and indeed not officially a Democratic nominee. And one could read 441 AD as not covering that at all. Now, what if we think that's the situation? Do we reach some constitutional issue? Or can we just say, gee, the statute doesn't cover it, and we'll postpone those bigger issues for an occasion when it does?
If the court reached such a decision, Justice O'Connor, it would still leave Section 441 AD as limiting some form of speech, speech by my client.
Well, it would, but what do you think our doctrines are on reaching constitutional issues unnecessarily?
I believe that in prior cases involving restrictions on campaign speech, the court has addressed specific statutory limitations, including, of course, most expansively in the Buckley decision, but it did so also in the Nick Pack decision in terms of evaluating a particular statute under a declaratory judgment request by a party such as my client.
You had a separate counterclaim asking for declaratory judgment and that making a facial attack on the statute, so that even if we found against the government's claim against the Republican Party, we would still have to adjudicate the disposition that was made of your claim against the commission, which was a facial challenge, as I gather.
Yes, Justice Scalia, that is our position. We had a separate, discrete counterclaim. It was part of our answer. The discovery that took place in the district court focused on that issue as well as the other issues.
And your grievance here is not just that you were punished for this violation, but you don't think you should be subject in the future to this provision at all.
Yes, that is correct.
For purposes of the counterclaim, is it your position that subsection D covers any expenditure that the party might make which is not a coordinated expenditure?
That is the interpretation of the statute that we have agreed with the government on, that this limitation, as it was intended, and certainly as it is applied by the Federal Election Commission, applies to both coordinated contributions, which are in fact coordinated with the candidate, and also contributions that may not factually be proved to be coordinated.
Well, I thought the government's position was that all of your expenditures were coordinated.
As a de jure matter, yes.
Yeah, well, do you agree with that?
Well, we concur with the congressional judgment that de jure coordination is good policy. because it precludes otherwise...
I just want to know what your position is in the litigation under your facial challenge. Do you agree with the government that every expenditure you might make that could be subject to subsection D is a coordinated expenditure?
As a matter of law, yes. As a matter of fact, no.
Well, I'm not quite sure where I go from there. If you agree that as a matter of law it is, what's left?
Well, we have what everyone seems to acknowledge is a unique relationship with candidates. It's unlike...
thought you took the position here that this wasn't a coordinated expenditure. It was at a time when there wasn't even a nominee, and it was an independent expression of viewpoint. Mm. Now, I understood from your briefs that was your position. Have you given that up?
We have pointed out in our briefs, Justice O'Connor, that whether there was no inquiry by the Federal Election Commission as to whether or not this particular expenditure was coordinated.
No, but this is the facial challenge. It doesn't matter. For purposes of your facial challenge under D, do you take the position that every expenditure is every expenditure that you might make, that could be subject to that as a matter of law, is a coordinated expenditure?
We accept that proposition, Justice.
Well, Mr. Barron, you can't just walk in off the street and make a facial challenge to a statute. You have to show that the statute affects you in some way, certainly.
Well, I don't believe there's any dispute that my client, the Colorado Republican Party, wishes to and indeed does engage and express advocacy in support of its candidates.
But you say even though we find the statute wouldn't apply to the activities that you've been challenged on here, nonetheless you can challenge it facially?
I believe that the declaratory judgment procedure that's afforded parties allows them to raise a claim that...
Yes, but you have to have some sort of standing to challenge a statute even facially.
Well, we are a state committee as defined by this statute, which specifically applies to state political parties and specifically limits our ability to spend money for some defined speech. Now, the commission...
In this case, you did not name the Democratic candidate that you were opposing because the Democratic candidate hadn't been... or the Republican candidate that you were favoring because the Republican candidate hadn't even been named yet. Isn't that right? But in a future case, you might want to go beyond what you did in this case and actually favor a particular Republican candidate. Isn't that right?
That was the claim in the district court when we made the...
And this provision would prevent it.
I don't think there's any dispute that this provision would apply to us or any other state committee that wish to engage in covered speech.
With respect to the as-applied challenge, even if you won with that, you'd still be subject to the limitation that you cannot support a Republican candidate except within the limitations of 421D.
That is correct.
But even if you made the expenditure that Justice Scalia referred to, you still take the position that it may be treated, as the government says, as a coordinated expenditure.
Yes, Justice Souter.
Does it follow from that? I'm not sure that I'm understanding the terms that everybody uses, so forgive a question that maybe I shouldn't have to ask, but does it follow from your position that if everything that you might expend should be treated as a coordinated expenditure, that therefore every expenditure you make should be treated for constitutional purposes as a contribution to someone?
It's our position that it should be evaluated in two ways. One is, of course, how is it labeled under the statute? And, of course, Congress has provided certain labels which may, in fact, have...
I thought we've gotten to the point of your saying any such expenditure, mm-hmm, which could be covered by D, mm-hmm, about which we are complaining in the facial challenge, is a coordinated expenditure. So taking that as the point from which the question starts, does it follow from that every expenditure in question here should be treated for constitutional purposes as a contribution to someone?
It should be treated for constitutional purposes under the strict scrutiny that this court requires, whether...
Well, how about a yes or no answer? Should it be treated as a contribution or not?
We don't believe that it should be treated as a contribution in terms of a shorthand resolution of whether or not this satisfies the First Amendment.
Then explain to me the sense of coordinated expenditure that you're using, because I take it you are not using coordinated expenditure to mean coordinated with a particular named candidate, because at the time in question here, and I suppose at other times, there won't be one. So in what sense is it a coordinated expenditure?
I believe the answer, Justice Souter, is that it's a coordinated expenditure by virtue of the predicament or situation that political parties are in that no one else is in.
No, but tell me what you mean by coordinated expenditure. Define the term as you are using it and as you understand the government is using it.
Well, as I'm using the term, it can be in two contexts because they are used interchangeably. One is a reference to a factual determination under a provision of the Section 441A as to whether or not there has been consultation with a candidate and coordination with the candidate. At the same time...
That didn't happen in this case, I take it. There wasn't any candidate.
There were three nameless candidates which were referred to in the record and which are cited in the passages of the government.
Well, would it be proper in this case then, and hence in considering the facial challenge, to consider the expenditure as being coordinated with them and to treat them as candidates?
Yes,
would that
be
fair?
Yes, I think
so. All right, if that is fair then, and that's the sense in which you are using coordinated expenditure, then why isn't it the case that every expenditure that would be subject to your facial challenge is one which, for constitutional purposes, should be treated as a contribution, from which it would follow that in judging the facial validity of the statute, we're really talking about a statute that regulates contributions rather than expenditures? Maybe there's some point in the logic that I'm going astray, but I don't see where it is.
I don't believe that the contributions-expenditure dichotomy that's articulated in Buckley falls neatly into this type of situation.
Well, I'm just having trouble understanding the argument, because I thought you have agreed that it's a coordinated expenditure, that it's coordinated in the sense that it is to be attributed at least to the three, or perhaps to the ultimate winner of the three. And I don't see, once you get to that point, why we're not, for constitutional purposes, talking about contributions, and hence the challenge is a challenge to a limit on contributions. I'm just not understanding the terms of the
difference. It can be viewed in that light, Justice Souter. It does not result in a conclusion as to the constitutionality of such a restriction.
Well, I'm not saying what the conclusion is. I'm just saying, what is the problem about which we must come to a conclusion? And it seems to me that based on the premises that you agree to, it must be a problem about contributions.
I would say that it could be in the same context as a limit on a candidate, which of course was reviewed by this court in Buckley, and whether the candidate spends his or her own money or whether the candidate does it in coordination with his or her campaign committee doesn't seem to have any constitutional significance once the analysis is conducted of strict scrutiny regarding what kind of speech and what kind of spending is affected by the restriction.
We reserved this precise question in Buckley, did we not?
I believe that is correct.
So evidently we did not deem that if it is considered a contribution, that's an end of the matter.
That would be our position, and obviously our hope, Justice Scalia. And the only analysis of this provision in Buckley was with respect to a Fifth Amendment equal protection claim.
I take it it's your position that even if it is treated as a contribution, the limit is still unconstitutional. I'm not suggesting that you give your case away necessarily by doing that, but is it fair to treat it as a contribution for analytical purposes here, based on your premises?
I think it presents difficulty either way because of the nature of the party, the nature of what is being limited here, and it's still, there's no other participant in political debate or politics that is in our shoes. None. No corporation, no political action committee, no individual contributor.
A political action committee. Why do you differ from a political action committee?
They do not nominate candidates. There is a legal and substantive distinction between political parties and other participants. Now, that distinction doesn't necessarily automatically lead to a particular constitutional result, but it is a difference that I believe must be acknowledged.
And it's like a candidate expenditure, you're saying.
I believe the closest analogy to this limit is with respect to the relationship of a candidate to his or her own campaign. And the campaign is the candidate's own effort. In this case, in fact, we are being portrayed as, I think one of the amici's called us, a joint venturer with the candidates, which has
but
never been...
But this difference is there not, Mr. Maron, that one who contributes to the candidate is not thereafter blocked from also contributing to the party. So you can't just put them all in the same pot.
I believe that the candidates are and their campaigns have to raise their money subject to contribution limits and all the same prohibitions.
If I exceed my, if I make up to the limit my contribution to the candidate, I can nonetheless make an independent contribution to the party without exceeding the candidate limit.
Only if you do not designate or condition your contribution to the party. And there is a specific provision that says that you cannot go to the party and say, I would like to give you now my $5,000 and I would like it to be used only for the benefit of candidate Smith, who already has received my $1,000.
But let's assume we're already into the election season. The candidate has been nominated, is being sponsored by the party. I make my contribution to the candidate, I can make another contribution to the party.
As a statutory matter, Justice Ginsburg, I believe that this restriction on contributions of that sort apply at all times and cannot be earmarked for the benefit of any candidate without counting towards the contributor's $1,000 contribution limit.
Yes, but I'm just trying to establish the basic point that they're not one and the same. The party, you can contribute to the party unrestricted and to the candidate, and you're not... stopped because you have contributed to the candidate. I'm also contributing to the party.
That is correct.
There's a limit on the party.
There's a limit.
Isn't there the amount you can give to the party?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
Isn't there a limit on the amount you can give to the party?
Yes, there are limits. They were imposed on parties in the 1976 amendments. There is a $5,000 annual limit on any individual or political committee contribution to my client, the state party. There is a category of national party committees that have a higher limit, $20,000. All of those contributions from any individual are further subject to an annual $25,000 limit. So if, in the hypothetical case that's been advanced in some of the briefs, an individual contributed $20,000 to a national party committee, that individual may not contribute more than $5,000 additional dollars through the rest of the year for all political purposes relating to federal elections.
It does remain under your theory that you say the political party is unique in response to Justice Scalia's question is different from a PAC because you nominate candidates. Suppose four or five PACs put up a candidate in a primary and backed that candidate for the party, and maybe the institutional party leaders might prefer someone else. Why couldn't it be said that they are nominating a candidate? I'd like you to just explore for me a little bit more this distinction you make between the party on the one hand and the PAC on the other, because you see where your reasoning would take us. It could very well be that we'd have to strike down the limits on spending by PACs as well.
I don't believe that is the case, Justice Kennedy. A political party is separately defined and has to meet separate criteria legally, not only in the Federal Election Campaign Act, but under virtually every state law. There are provisions that specify what a party is. And a party obviously has to have some continuity. It must have some demonstration of support. It must have nominated candidates, which candidates then have attracted some level of voter support. And in fact, if that doesn't happen, the parties, either as a practical matter, go out of existence, or under virtually every state law, whoever they nominate do not automatically qualify for the ballot. So there is an entire statutory body of law at both the federal and state level that deals with parties differently. And that difference is accountable for the fact that, unlike any other group, they join together, they call themselves something, they select their members to run for office, and they present them to the public. And what this statute does is it says, well, once you have done all that, And you want to tell not just the public, but you want to even tell party members why they should support the candidates you have nominated. The federal law says you can only do it up to a limit, and thereafter you have to stop.
But maybe
advocating.
It should work the other way. If the party has all those attributes of what we can loosely call a state actor, perhaps it should be subject to more restrictions, quite properly so, than a group of citizens who form a PAC.
I'm not aware of any precedent that characterizes political party speech as a state speech, and that we are actually speaking for ourselves and our adherents, and the, hopefully with the support of the candidates who have agreed to associate with us and to run for public
office. But
that's
even more true of private groups, organizations that contribute through PACs, is it not?
Well, each group is going to have to be evaluated in terms of how they relate to the compelling government interest that is being advanced to justify what everyone has to acknowledge is a restriction on our speech. And to that extent, is the relationship of a political party in terms of its activities different than that of a PAC? Is it different from that of a corporation or a union or an individual contributor? And our position is that the answer has to be yes, it clearly is different. And why? It's because their whole purpose for being is to engage in political activity, to advance a common philosophy, and to nominate candidates who necessarily are part of the party. They're party members, and we present them. Now, what the statute then does is says, well, unlike even corporations, unlike unions, unlike any other association in America, when it comes to communicating on political issues with your own members, you become subject to this limit. And in addition, if you start communicating
well,
to the public, you become subject to this limit.
In exchange for not being subject to the other limit, and you want to get out of this one and not get into the other one. Right?
Well,
I mean, there are other limits that apply to PAC, which the government has tried to present its case as presenting that one.
Well, we are put in the...
It sets up a separate limit for political parties, which is different from the limits that apply to PACs. And you want to get out of this one, but not get into the other one. Or are, will you be happy if we put you in with the PACs?
Obviously not, Justice Scalia. And the reason is that...
Well, then you really can't paint yourself as being so much put upon. I mean, maybe more put upon than a political party ought to be, you can say that, but you can't really paint yourself as being in an even worse position than PACs.
I believe that we are. In fact, we would be better off if we called ourselves a union and called every member of the Republican Party a union member. Then we would be able to spend unlimited, undisclosed amounts of money in our partisan communications with our members. And then in addition, we could then, as a union party, create a political action commission committee, which in addition can then raise voluntary donations to fund those political activities, which may include unlimited independent expenditures. What I have just described is speech activity that is provided to that element of unions or corporations with respect to their stockholders and management, but comes subject to this limit. Nobody else is in a predicament where they have no alternative legally to some form of unlimited partisan expression, either with their core constituency of members or with respect to the public in general, as would be the case with independent expression.
Barron, there's a basic question I wonder if you would indulge, and that is, you have conceded, I think, that the statute calls this a coordinated expenditure, and it ranks it specifically as a contribution. In your uneasiness in answering what this animal was, are you suggesting to this court that it ought to rethink the distinction between contribution and expenditures, or are you willing to go along with that and say, even though it's a contribution, it's still unconstitutional?
I believe that even as a contribution under this situation, the government has not justified this burden, and it would have to be declared unconstitutional. I wish to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Very well, Mr. Barron. General Days, we'll hear from you.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I wanted to take a few minutes to just clarify the scheme that's at work here under the Campaign Act. Under the Act, an expenditure is defined as something that's expended for purposes of influencing an election. And expenditures are considered coordinated expenditures where a political party is concerned. And if they are coordinated expenditures, then they are viewed as contributions, which would then be covered by the contribution limits and the doctrines that this court has announced. The petitioners have accepted this scheme and accepted that their expenditures should be viewed as coordinated expenditures. So they've accepted this as a theoretical matter, but I would like to point out also that on this record there's evidence of actual coordinated expenditures. The party chairman in this case admitted that even though there wasn't a Republican candidate at the time, that he was coordinating with all three Republican candidates, and certainly the Federal Election Commission has held for some years.
If there was no candidate, you say there was no candidate nominated, but the party chairman was coordinating with all three candidates.
That's
you
right.
You mean putative candidates, or?
No, they were candidates for the nomination of the party to run for the Senate against the already declared Democratic candidate.
So the Republican Party in Colorado had not nominated anyone, but several people were angling or seeking the nomination.
That's correct, and the Federal Election Commission has pointed out that there's nothing in the Act that requires that there have been a nominee selected before this principle applies. The statute itself refers to candidates. It does not refer to nominees, and there are parts of the statute where the Congress has used nominee when it intended to make that point. That's not the case in this particular situation. So we're, in analyzing this particular situation, faced with a coordinated expenditure that is a contribution. It's a form of contribution. It strikes us that the petitioners have refused to accept, Justice Ginsburg, the distinction that this court has drawn for many, many years since Buckley between limiting contributions and limiting expenditures. As this court has said, there's a fundamental constitutional difference between those two types of limitation.
But the party's point here is that if you regard it as an entirely separate entity from the candidate, yes, you can view it as a contribution. But the party is itself running, in a way. The party engages in the election. And viewed at from, you know, viewed in that light, it constitutes an expenditure. To be sure, it's coordinated with the candidate. They're sort of saying the party and the candidate are one.
I understand their position, but this court has held that if we're talking about contribution limits, Congress had a compelling justification for imposing such limitations in order to prevent corruption or the appearance of corruption. So the question is, are the limitations that are imposed on coordinated expenditures in the form of contributions in the form of coordinated expenditures by parties subject to that same type of analysis?
How much can I buy for $20,000 given to the Colorado Republican Party with no strings attached?
What do you mean, how much can you buy?
What quid pro quo? We're talking corruption here. I have to give the Colorado Republican Party $20,000. That's the limit, right? $20,000. Not $20,000. $5,000.
$5,000 to the party. $20,000 to the national.
To the national. Okay, yes, I give $5,000 to the Colorado Party. No strings attached. They can give it to any candidate at all. What do you think I can purchase for that? I don't think too much.
I'm not sure I can tell you it as a factual matter, but I think the point is, one, we're talking about corruption as defined by this court. What this court said was that corruption is a subversion of the political process. Elected officials are influenced to act contrary to their obligations of office by the prospect of financial gain to themselves or the infusions of money into their campaign.
But I would think it's quite diffused if it flows to the party without designation. It's a step removed, isn't it, from anything that we've upheld? You have to acknowledge that.
I do acknowledge that, but this court in the California Medical Association case was confronted with the same argument that the PAC there served as a buffer or a filter between contributions by the medical association to the candidate, and this court rejected that argument and nevertheless saw that as a problem for preventing evasion of the limitations on individual contributions.
But in Massachusetts Citizens for Life, the court narrowed a reading of the statute because it felt that not-for-profit corporations were in a different position than corporations for profit.
Yes,
so we have accounted for differences, you know, factual differences, with either different readings of the statute.
Mr. Chief Justice, I respectfully disagree. I think that what this court was addressing in the Massachusetts Citizens for Life was the question of how expenditures should be defined. And what this court concluded was, one, expenditures in the form of independent expenditures should be viewed as covered by the Act only where there was express advocacy. But there was no treatment of the question of limitations on contributions. What we're talking about here are limitations on contributions.
That construction was given because a nonprofit corporation was involved. Previously, it had appeared that corporations generally were subject to this general rule.
That's certainly correct. But, Mr. Chief Justice, what the petitioners are arguing for here is an unlimited right to spend funds that are coordinated, either in fact or in theory, without any of the limitations that presently exist under the Act.
One part is cloudy to me about what falls within coordinated expenditures that equal contributions.
Yes.
Suppose before Worth announced his candidacy for the Senate, but he's in Congress, and the Republican Party thinks, well, this guy may someday run. So they do the same kind of advertising.
Yes.
But not only isn't there any Republican candidate, Worth himself hasn't declared himself as in the ring for the Senate. What would such an expenditure be then?
My reading of that, given what the Federal Election Commission has done up to this point, is that that would not be viewed as covered by this particular provision. The fact that Worth might at some point become a candidate does not mean that the party can't comment on issues that affect his discharging of his responsibilities as a representative of Colorado or a district in Colorado in the United States House of Representatives.
What is the line at which this statute starts to run? Is it when either party has a declared candidate, not yet nominated, but declared?
Well, Justice Ginsburg, I don't know whether there's any precise temporal point, but one can imagine an ad run by the party with respect to Tim Worth that says, we disagree with Tim Worth's position, and by the way, he's likely to run for the Senate, and therefore we want you to know about this. It seems to me that the inclusion, even though it might be out of the structure of the election framework, would nevertheless be focused on an election. And that's one of the things that's important about this particular ad, Worth Facts Number 1. It not only talks about Tim Worth's positions with respect to defense and the balanced budget, it makes specific reference to the fact that he's running for the Senate. It struck the commission that this was not a difference in degree, but a difference in kind, insofar as the Act was concerned.
General Days, isn't your argument broad enough, though, that if the morning after this senatorial election was over, the Republican Party in Colorado started running advertisements generally favoring Republicans and disfavoring Democrats, there isn't going to be another election for at least 2 years.
Yes.
Isn't it your position or the FEC's position that that would still be a coordinated expenditure?
No, it would not.
How do we draw this line? Because, I mean, I thought your answer to Justice Ginsburg might be, well, there's no line to be drawn. But if there is going to be one to be drawn, how do we draw it? Or how does the
commission has attempted to deal with this issue, and we refer to it on, I believe, page 3 of our brief. There's something called generic communications,
yeah,
which say vote Republican, support the Republican Party.
Yeah, now, are those independent? Or are they to be treated as coordinated?
They're viewed as expenditures, but they're not coordinated because there's no one to be coordinated with.
Exactly. So what do we do if we think there is such a thing, there is such an animal, contrary to what your opponent here says today? Suppose we think there is such a thing as an independent party expenditure. There is such an animal. And that they can't be constitutionally limited. Do we narrow the construction of 441 A.D.? What do we do?
Justice O'Connor, I think that the Act already recognizes that there are matters that can be addressed by the party that are not regarded as coordinated expenditures. Money for get-out-the-vote, slate cards, ballots, and things of that kind, which the Act does not even regard as contributions or expenditures. So
this sounds like the express. This sounds like the express advocacy theory, which you don't want us to adopt.
No, we don't think the express advocacy standard is the correct one because express.
The examples you're giving are examples that would not be acts of express advocacy. You know, get out the vote. That's not an ad. You know.
Well, what about the case? Supposing the day after the election, Congressman X, a Democrat, is reelected in Colorado. And the Republican Party publishes an ad that we didn't work hard enough, let's get him in the next election.
I think, well, that's a very difficult one to resolve, but I think that this would be a situation where it was so distant from the electoral cycle that that might not fall within the limits.
But
I think
be,
the mention of the election would push it in terms of what the commission has viewed more on the side of being a coordinated expenditure in connection with a campaign than otherwise.
Wouldn't it be easier at least to resolve if we did adopt the express advocacy limitation? Because in that case, in the Chief Justice's example, you would be engaging in express advocacy for a particular individual who was at least assumed to be a candidate the next time around. And so that would be an easier problem to resolve. May I just ask kind of a broader question,
yes,
of which this is just an example. If we adopted the express advocacy limitation, then wouldn't the problem that concerns Justice Ginsburg, Justice O'Connor, and me disappear because we really wouldn't have the kind of line-drawing problem that we would have on your view absent the express advocacy limitation?
It might be clear, but there are other clear rules that this court could adopt. It could say that any ad that mentions a clearly identified candidate with nothing else about electioneering message would certainly be a coordinated expenditure.
As I understand the proposal that Justice Souter makes, this would allow the Republican Party of Colorado to spend as much as it wanted on negative ads, right?
No, I don't think that's correct. Negative ads that would be talking about a specific candidate which said, don't vote for the Democratic candidate, that would not...
I thought the discussion was talking about an identifiable candidate that the Republican Party is supporting. By an identifiable candidate, you mean on either side?
Yes,
even
absolutely.
If you're just opposing the Democrat.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
General, I think there's two things that seem to be getting blended that should be kept separate. You are not questioning to say the statute doesn't cover speech by the party on issues unrelated to an election campaign.
That's correct.
And therefore you never get, with respect to items unrelated to a campaign, you never get to anything about express advocacy because it's simply not covered.
Well, that's right. And also,
so to get into the box, first of all, it has to be in connection with a campaign.
Yes,
that answers in good part Justice Souter's question.
Well, it does, and it also is talking about contributions. This court has never adopted the express advocacy standard with respect to contributions, but rather with regard to expenditures.
Yes, one question in respect to that. Focusing on expenditures for a person.
Yes.
But independent, really independent.
Yes.
Forgetting what the law says. Vote for X, don't vote for Y. He's a good Republican, he's a good Democrat. All right, I'm focusing on that. I take it, and I don't understand the constitutional basis for the distinction. Under the First Amendment, what would the theory be? An individual, if he's really independent, can spend as much as he wants.
Yes.
A PAC, if he's really independent, can spend as much as he wants. But a political party the function of which is to help democracy by translating people's wishes into a government, cannot spend anything. Now, if I've stated that correctly, what's the justification under the First Amendment for that?
The justification, Justice Breyer, I think, is reality, that everyone recognizes that it's inconceivable to think in terms of a party making a truly independent expenditure, independent of the candidate.
Right, so which way does that cut?
Well, I think it cuts in terms of, one, justifying the view that any expenditure by a party is a coordinated expenditure.
Right, but
and
which
is a
way
contribution.
Does that cut? If you can't draw the line, does that mean everything should be treated as if it were a contribution? Or does it mean that everything should be treated as if it were an expenditure?
I think it should be treated as a contribution.
Because?
The Congress was concerned that if there were unlimited amounts of money used as contributions to candidates or in the political process, that might lead to either actual corruption or the appearance of corruption.
But you've told us here today that you think there are some independent expenditures possible for a political party, so that doesn't quite track.
Well, let me be clear.
And also, under the statute, I think we are still dealing, are we not, with 441 A.D.?
Yes, we are.
I mean, that we're trying to
That's
interpret
correct.
It. And then determine, I gather, its constitutionality as
yes.
interpreted.
Yes.
And subsection 3 says that a national or state or local committee may not make any expenditure in connection with the general election campaign of a candidate for federal office in a state who is affiliated with such party.
Yes.
Who is affiliated with such party? So in this case, it would mean it would have to be a Republican candidate for a federal office for this to even apply.
Yes, and I guess I'm not following you, Justice O'Connor.
Well,
as to how that
would leave room
here.
For lots of independent expenditures, in my view, and maybe it leaves open all negative ads.
No,
against the other party. Conceivably, it does. And do we normally try to give statutes a narrow interpretation to avoid striking them down as unconstitutional?
Yes, but I think, Justice O'Connor, what the Federal Election Commission has done in interpreting the act as one concluded that any expenditures by parties are coordinated expenditures and are contributions, and then what we have in 4 AD 3 is really an authorization for the parties to spend more money than any other entity can or it could under the regular provisions of the Act. That is, in this case, it could have spent $100,000, the Republican Party, the petitioners, but decided not to do that. So the contribution limit is one that has to be evaluated using the principles that this Court has announced in Buckley and other cases. And what we are arguing is that Congress's limitation on contributions by political parties is consistent with that norm. Although parties and candidates may share some agreement, there's no reason to think that if, as the petitioners want, there would be unlimited contributions made by the party, that might not stimulate corruption or at least the appearance of corruption. And secondly, if this were an open spigot, so to speak, there might be room for evasion of the individual limits, as this Court was concerned about in Buckley.
Going back to the 441 AD 3 that Justice O'Connor just
yes.
asked you about, it says that a political party may not make an expenditure in connection with the general election campaign. It certainly isn't ineluctably clear that general election campaign doesn't mean after both parties have nominated a candidate.
Mr. Chief Justice, I suppose one could read it that way, but we come back to the role of the Commission in the scheme, and the Commission is entrusted by the Act with the responsibility for interpreting the Act.
But when you're dealing
and enforcing
with
the
First Amendment, I think some of our cases say that even an agency interpreting the Act has to go kind of slowly.
Well, that's certainly the case, but there's nothing in the Act that suggests that the reading that you were proposing is the correct reading.
If you ask people on the street, what do you mean when you say the general election campaign has started? I think you would say, a lot of people would say, well, it's when the two major parties have chosen their candidates. I think people are talking the presidential campaign now just in those terms.
I think the reality that the Congress was looking at and that the commission has viewed suggests that there should be a larger room for the applicability of 441A.
It doesn't say during general election campaign anyway. It says in connection with.
Well, and also when it
before says, that campaign begins, that's directed to that campaign as far as the text is concerned.
Yes. I think that's correct, and I mentioned the point that it mentions candidates, not nominees. I wanted to turn, if I may, to the point that was made about whether this court has to reach the constitutional issue. It strikes us that what the petitioners are presenting, if indeed they win on the view that 441AD3 should not apply, is highly theoretical. That this is a political party committee that has never shown an inclination to spend as much money as the statute allows. Indeed, it's turned back the money on each instance in which it's given that money. So it strikes us that the court would not have to reach the constitutional issue. And as was suggested by you, Justice O'Connor, wait for another day to resolve this larger issue.
Excuse
of its
me,
constitutionality.
Why don't we have to reach it, even though it's been presented in a separate counterclaim? Because there's no standing?
No, I'm not suggesting that at all. It has to do with, among other things, the prudential determinations by this court that it should not reach a constitutional issue if it can resolve the case on something short of a constitutional
issue. It can't resolve this declaratory judgment request without resolving the constitutional issue. Do we have the authority to say we're not going to entertain this action for a declaratory judgment because we don't think it's prudent?
They specifically allege that they could and would have exceeded the limits but for the statute.
Yes, but I think that we have volunteers all over the place, Justice Stevens, who might in some future set of circumstances want to do something that the law does not allow.
So you say they have no standing. That's your argument, that they have no standing because, in fact, there's no indication that that they had any...
Well, it can be either standing or it can be the fact that they may have standing in some minimal sense, but that prudential... reasons would justify the courts not resolving this because they are free of whatever coercive.
They have no right controversy because they've never, although in theory they could certainly not give the money to the national
party. That's right. They're volunteering.
So it's premature.
Absolutely.
General Days, may I go back, assuming we reach that constitutional issue, may I go back to was essentially the corruption point. Let's assume D3 were to be declared unconstitutional, facially. What would the government's position be? What do you think your position could be under the statute? If following that, individuals made $5,000 contributions to the Colorado Party and said, we want this $5,000 to be used in X's campaign for the Senate, or Y's campaign for the House, would the government have any objection to the parties acceding to those requests?
Yes, I think that we would then turn to 441AA, which is the basic statutory provision with respect to contributions. And therefore, even if 441AD3 or AD were out of the picture, we would nevertheless, if this were a coordinated contribution, have to go back to the central statute.
Well, where does your corruption argument go? Because I thought your strongest corruption argument was that if you declare the statute unconstitutional, in effect, they can make a bypass of the limitation on contributions to candidates. And now you're saying, I think, no, they couldn't do that.
No, I think that one of the curious things about the position that petitioners have taken in this litigation is that they viewed 441AD3 as a limitation, when in fact it's an authorization. And we think the legislative history and the statute itself, that is 441AD, reflect the fact that Congress viewed that as an exception to the otherwise
limited version. Okay, but there then wouldn't be, then where does the end run argument go? Doesn't that defeat your end run argument?
Well, the end run argument has to do with the fact that they would be allowed to make unlimited contributions to the candidate, but that does not necessarily follow.
Okay, so that's you're not resting your position on that.
No, but our point with respect to the corruption is that although the limits of individual contributions and political committee contributions would remain the same, it would be possible to, if you will, focus and target these amounts of monies in a way that would not be possible.
The parties could, right.
The parties could.
Well, that is, may I ask you then one other question? That assumes that if subsection 3 falls, subsection 1 remains. Is it your position? Is it your position?
441AA.
Pardon me?
441AA, if we're talking about the same provision.
Your position is that D as a whole would have to fall.
That's what I'm getting at,
Yes.
And then you're back to the beginning of the statute.
That's correct.
And they're still, and they're under that tighter prohibition.
That's correct.
That's right. So if D3 falls, D1 falls too, in your view. You can't pick off D3 alone.
Oh, of course,
right.
Of course. Yes, I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about the major statute.
Yeah.
But going to this question of corruption, the court has never concluded, nor did Congress, that, for example, family members would be likely to seek undue influence with their own family members, but nevertheless upheld the limitation on contributions by family members to their own sons and daughters and wives and husbands. So the point is not necessarily that there would be actual corruption, but the appearance of corruption. And I think that what the statute reflects and what this court's decisions reflect is that there is a significant corruptive potential in large amounts of money.
I don't understand what you mean by corruptive potential. If you mean that by spending a lot of money for a particular candidate, that is, making a lot of speech on behalf of that candidate, you're likely to promote the ideas that you're interested in.
I'm not suggesting that.
That's not corruption.
You're
going to get back some money for it. You're going to get the guy to do something that will line your pockets.
Well, not necessarily line your pockets, line the pockets of your campaign. That is, foster your political career in ways that are contrary to what otherwise would be your best judgment. I think that is the teaching of Buckley and the other decisions of this court.
It is corruption to induce a candidate to support certain philosophical principles by making a donation to him?
It is not corruption, but I think the difference, Justice Scalia, is in the amount of money. I think Congress in the Campaign Act recognized that political parties could exert certain influence on their candidates and on their elected officials and make them do a variety of things.
It's called party discipline.
Yes, they always have and they always
will. So long as there's no exchange of money, I have never considered it corruption. I've considered it good old-fashioned democratic politics.
Well, I think that, with respect, Justice Scalia, in Buckley, this court rejected the notion that the anti-bribery statutes would be a way of dealing with this particular problem and that Congress could deal with the situation.
You're assuming the problem. Justice Scalia's question is there's no problem. There's no problem when candidates feel sufficiently beholden to a party to act in accordance with the party's philosophy. Where is the government's interest in destroying that relationship?
It's not destroying that relationship. It stems from the fact that with unlimited amounts of money, there is a potential for the parties or other entities forcing a candidate to do
things. How about other entities?
Otherwise
we're just talking about parties here.
Yes, but there are limitations on contributions that can be made. What we're talking about here and what petitioners are urging is money that, in effect, goes directly to the candidate in unlimited amounts of money. Unlimited amounts.
Thank you, General Days. Mr. Barron, you have 4 minutes remaining.
I would like to clarify, hopefully, a couple of statutory issues that were raised.
Before you get to that, Mr. Barron, let me tell you one thing that's really troubling me. Is it true that it doesn't make a whole lot of difference? I mean, you complain in your brief and you complain here, you can only spend a few pennies ahead, and the Solicitor General says you don't want to spend more than that anyway. Does this make any real difference to party politics in the United States?
Anytime the decision-making of a speaker becomes his or her own decision as opposed to the government's decision, it matters. And in practical terms, this does allow the political parties to make their decisions based on where they think their political speech would be most effective.
As a practical matter, it would give the parties, through this form of speech, an influence and a control over candidates, which in the last few decades they have lost. That's the practical effect, isn't it?
It makes them more relevant than they have been in the last couple of decades.
It gives them clout. It will give them clout with their candidates, won't it?
Well,
isn't that what's really at stake? That's why they want to engage in this kind of speech. You want to restore party discipline.
Justice Souter, political parties believe they have a proper role in public debate about campaigns and about issues. And about that's what party platforms are about. That's what nominating candidates are all about. And this section tells the parties they can only engage in that public debate up to a point.
So your answer is yes. Nothing to be ashamed of in party discipline. Your answer is yes, you will influence your candidates to support Republican positions more than they otherwise would.
Yes.
You're ashamed of that.
I'm too sensitive to perhaps the jargon of some, and I don't mean you, Justice Souter, that you know having clout is a pejorative term, and it does allow them to say more and hopefully to have more persuasive effect. I would point out that with respect to this assertion that this spending is highly theoretical, the record is fairly clear that with respect to the 1986 election cycle, the Colorado Party spent $1.1 million for all of its activities. So it is theoretically possible, was then, is today, to spend money, if that were the party's decision, for the type of speech in excess of the limits as provided here. With respect to when a individual is a candidate, which is a very important question raised by Justice Ginsburg, I point out that the definition of a candidate in the Federal Election Campaign Act is any individual who has raised or spent more than $5,000 in campaign funds. That means that every person across the street is a candidate under the Act almost the day after election. And in fact, Congressman Wirth, before he became a candidate for the Senate, was prior to that time, between the 1984 election and up to the point where he declared his candidacy for the Senate, he was a candidate for re-election to the House of Representatives.
Which section defines candidate that way?
That is in Section 431, which is a definitional section of the Act, Your Honor, and there is a discrete definition of a candidate. I would also point out that
definition of, what are the other words, in connection with is there a definition of general election campaign?
There is not.
Thank you, Mr. Barron. The case is submitted. We'll